Good afternoon. Welcome to the Nurse and Midwife Support Podcast, Your Health Matters. I'm Ellie Brown, and I'm the Stakeholder Engagement Coordinator for Nurse and Midwife Support. I am a registered nurse. Nurse and Midwife Support is national, anonymous, confidential, and free. Available 24/7, and you can call anytime you need support on 1800 667 877 or contact us via the website nmsupport.org.au. I would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which each of us are listening. I pay my respects to First Nations elders past and present. I extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening to this podcast. Sovereignty was never ceded. Today I will be speaking with Dr. Finbar Hopkins. She has over 30 years' experience as a registered nurse, mental health nurse, and midwife. Finn has a keen interest in the emotional and psychological cost of caring and the impact of post-traumatic stress disorder on nurses and midwives. Good afternoon, Finn.
Good afternoon, Elle, and thank you for inviting me here to participate in this lovely podcast. And very timely one too.
Finn, would you mind telling us what is it about the nature of their work that predisposes nurses and midwives to getting PTSD?
Of course, yes, I will. And I want to acknowledge all nurses and midwives and healthcare practitioners in particular, that every one of us have lived experience of some form of mental distress. So that's, I'll just preface my words with that. But really, when I think about what has, how's post-traumatic stress, like the work, how does that work of nurses and midwives? It's the emotional exposure to traumatic events, because nurses and midwives, they work in high stress environments, as we know, where they encounter traumatic events regularly, and they may also witness injuries, deaths, or other complications during birth, childbirth as well, which can be emotionally overwhelming and lead to PTSD. And it's quite complex, the other issues as well, such as emotional engagement. If we think about nurses and midwives, often, very frequently, their work is relational. They're deeply involved in providing care to patients and their families. And the emotional engagement, of course, comes at a cost. It can make them susceptible to the emotional impact of the work and lead to some of the symptoms, not saying PTSD, but lead to some of the symptoms of PTSD. Another factor could be that they work very long hours. Nurses and midwives working long shifts, and that may increase chronic fatigue as well as sleep disturbances, and they can again contribute to the development of PTSD. We also know that hospitals have history of being very hierarchical and not lacking in support because of a lack of understanding, time, busyness, and also emotional support has been traditionally seen as being weak, and there hasn't been opportunities either for counselling or EAP, employee assistance program, have only kind of started to come to the fore post-COVID. They have been there, but yeah, they haven't been taken up very well because it hasn't been seen as very important, the emotional and mental health care. And that, of course, leads me into that stigma in, asking for help is very stigmatized, or has been, I would say, pre-COVID. In my work now as a well-being consultant, I'm seeing nurses and midwives and other health professionals are much more readily coming forward with their mental health concerns, and they are looking for support. The other thing, of course, that can predispose nurses and midwives to PTSD is coping with loss. Often they're experiencing loss of patients, and they're expected to move on to the next patient, get on, and just keep going. And that attitude is especially in busy areas where they're short-staffed and that there isn't much time for to stop and think, oh, how has this impacted on me, to tune into themselves. And of course, there is workplace stressors. I mean, there's very fast, very dynamic, and especially working in areas like ED, where there's a high rate of patients coming in and distressed and not enough beds and piling up like that. So those workplace stressors really do impact. The other thing that contributes to the work of nurses and midwives and developing PTSD can be the stage they're at in their career, particularly between the years of 1 to 4 years. They can be in, you know, new and young, and they're quite vulnerable. And if they don't get adequate preceptorship or mentorship, that can result in them being more vulnerable to the development of PTSD. And we do know that recently there was a report that came out of the New South Wales Nurses Association, together with the the Rosemary Bryant Foundation from Adelaide, and they looked at 2,300 nurses. This was in 2022, and they found that there was about 1 in 15 were feeling totally overwhelmed, and particularly young career graduates were very vulnerable. So those are a mixture of the things that really can predispose people towards PTSD. But it's important that I stress here that even though with all of those stressors, not all nurses and midwives will develop it, but they will have a natural stress response if something critical that they perceive as critical or that impacts on them, that a normal stress response will result in their alarm system in their body being triggered. And that's doing the work of the body that it should be doing. It's saying something's not right here, so I'm triggering this alarm for you to check in with yourself and see what's happening. And that's a very healthy, normal response. But it can take, that stress response too, can take a few days or even up to a week to settle down again. People can feel a little bit hypervigilant during that time. But it doesn't mean they have PTSD. That's quite a different trajectory.
Ben, I'm asking you because you have a history of being a wellbeing consultant, your work. Yes. How can workplaces, managers and peers help to prevent PTSD, and how can they support nurses and midwives with PTSD?
Well, this post-COVID, I'm really gladdened in the sense the way that some of the hospitals that I've been in contact have really started to put in mental health education and training, especially in psychological first aid. And, you know, which it's a short training over a few hours of a day that really help managers in particular and team leaders to be able to check in with their staff when a critical incident, code black or code gray, is being called. They are able to check in with them in a way that is actually very supporting and caring and make sure that they are taking them away from the danger, and that they are checking out, they're not looking at facts so much as saying, are you okay? What do you need now? What could I get you? Will you be able to continue the shift? Should you go home? If you need to go home, is there somebody at home? Do we need to call somebody at home? Or can I get you a taxi voucher? And I will call you and I'll check in on you. So becoming much more sensitive and responsive to, hey, this is something big that's happened here for us. Let's support each other. And also calling if a hospital has a wellbeing team. The larger hospitals will, but the smaller ones may not have a wellbeing team. There will be psychologists, or there will be other counsellors or pastoral care workers that may be trained to actually do some checking in with people. And then, of course, we can EAP, the Employees Assistance Program, also is a very useful service. They will do a critical incident defuse. as will some well-being team members as well. They can do that as a group. They can get the nurses together, particularly ones that were directly impacted and were involved. And or they can do that individually or in group. And that's usually done over a phone consultation, or in the room if it's a group, or online. So these are kind of some of the things. The peer support program as well is very useful, where you get a colleague that's been trained specifically, a number of colleagues, and they're in the local area and they're trained, and they will generally wear a badge or are contactable via the switchboard, and they will come and have a conversation with somebody after a critical incident. So defusing is, and as I said, is important. When I say defuse, I mean you're looking at the facts of what happened, who was there, when did it happen, and you're trying to fill in the memory gaps that the person has so that they don't concoct or, you know, develop kind of false, oh yes, I should have done this, I shouldn't have done that. It's not about blaming or apportioning blame at all. It's more about getting the facts together so they can be clear in their memory. Oh, that's what happened. This is how it was. Of course, I'm not to blame. And that defusing is usually, as I said, done by well-being or EAP or somebody who's been trained in it, because it is pretty important that you lower the levels of arousal for people who've been involved in a critical incident. And then there's, after that, there is a period of watchful waiting where up to 4 to 6 weeks you actually check in on the person, see how they're going. But you do alert the person that they may have some changes in their behavior, their emotions, their cognitions. That may involve, you know, not eating, not sleeping, or feeling nauseous, headaches, irritability emotionally, cognitively, you know, having some thoughts or flashbacks. That doesn't mean you have PTSD. It's just the stress reaction that can be quite acute, especially over the first few days. And then that watchful waiting will be up to 6 weeks. And that means you check in with your manager as well. And the manager usually will be very supportive, giving you time, making sure you've got time off if you need to have time off, making sure you see your GP if you need to see your GP, and if you need any further support, and also making sure that you contact HR and see if there's any leave, because certain hospitals do have, and I think it's quite across the board, they have injury assist as well. And injury assist is giving you some time, not taking it out of your sick leave, but time for an injury that occurred at work. So these are helpful things. Flexible work schedules as well is really important. If nurses or midwives are starting to feel, oh, I'm just even without any critical incident, I'm feeling really tired, I'm exhausted, things are happening in my life. Well, then let's see where we can take some of the pressure off you. A lighter workload is very helpful. So making sure you don't schedule them with too heavy a load. Also making sure that if they need to go off early or if they need to start later, stuff like that. And having a trauma-informed environment. So being able to check in with your staff and say, how are things going? Any adjustments that I can do to help you? So if it's an office-based thing, can we have your office away from a high-stimulus area if you need low stimulus? Or if you're working in face-to-face with patients, you know, making sure that you're a fairly good match, and if not around people that are too anxious or themselves clients that might be traumatized. So always checking in is really important as well. And the wellness programs, most hospitals do run wellness programs now. So they are doing mindfulness, they are doing reflective practice, stuff like clinical supervision, which isn't point of care supervision. It's more a reflective group reflecting on your practice. All of those are designed to create a supportive work environment. But of course, there is the social aspects as well of making sure that people have their breaks and that you have if there's a cake to be shared or somebody's birthday. These are really important things that help to contain, and people feel supported and they feel valued. And feeling valued is a really important part of how nurses and midwives actually are sustain themselves to do this. Really, it's pretty intense work, and it has been made more so by the effects of COVID. You know, that has really brought it home to us all, the intensity of the work and the relentlessness at times. But then there's also the joy in that work. You know, people really, most people love their work, and to find that joy is through the, yeah, the social and creative work environments that are around.
Thanks, Finn. You mentioned it just before, but can you tell me about trauma-informed care and how that benefits both the work environment for nurses and midwives and also clinical care delivery?
Yeah, sure. Well, trauma-informed care is an approach to healthcare. It recognises and responds to the impact of trauma on individuals. And one of the few things, number of things it does, it's to promote safety, trust, empowerment in the healing process. So this approach is used with patients, but it's not only beneficial for patients, but also has a positive effect on the work environment. And it isn't about what is wrong with you. So there's a shift in that from what is wrong with you to what has happened to you. So that's kept front and center in most team leaders and managers when they are talking to nurses. They're talking to nurses about creating a safe, a physically safe and emotionally safe environment for them, and also being mindful if you recently had a trigger, what was happening there? You know, that what could we do that could actually support you to feel, you know, less aroused and be able to, you know, come to work feeling safe and feeling that you're working in an environment that really cared for you. So if sometimes if we have trouble with our memory, you know, as a result of, you know, feeling a bit stressed and that, one of the things that can be helpful is to provide job-related responsibilities, writing it down. So these are the kind of things that are really important today that I want you to get through. Allowing them, as I said before, to have flexible work schedules. That's important. Taking time off for treatment or for appointments. Also, letting employees wear noise-cancelling headphones if they're in, you know, in the office area, in a busy area, to cut down on distractions. Increasing the amount of light in the working environment, making sure people work in, and if they can't do that, having plants and just trying to mimic the natural environment if it's not possible to have more light. But also encouraging people to take, you know, to go for a walk outside, take 5 minutes or so or 10 minutes and just go for a walk out into the garden area, if there is a garden area attached to your work, sit for a moment and have a drink or a coffee. Just tune into yourself. Feel, oh, yeah, how am I traveling now? What's happening for me? What are my thoughts like? So these are kind of a number of things that people can, managers in particular, can do. And if there is our environmental triggers, say, for example, a client was, you know, really had, was behaving in a way that really triggered a staff, a nursing or midwife, actually getting the nurse to move from that client and getting somebody else to work in that area, if that's possible. And if it's not, then there needs to be two people working with that client so that we don't allow the nurse or the midwife to feel completely alone and isolated with a client or a patient. I use client because I come from a mental health background, but really what I'm speaking about here are patients. And then when nurses are going off shift as well, it's important that they, you know, are accompanied by somebody, because nurses recently, there's been quite a number of attacks of nurses in car parks and not very well lit areas. So getting security to walk them to their car. And yeah, things as like making sure that they are safe, not just in the hospital, but on their way home as well, getting home.
Thanks, Finn. That's a whole suite of interactions and things for people to think about doing and helping to provide trauma-informed care. It's good. Can you tell me about post-traumatic growth and how does that occur?
Yes, of course, yeah. It's a lovely concept, and it's really close to my heart that these experiences, also, although they may be difficult when you are feeling traumatized by whatever the experience and the impact has had on you, it's to know that there is light at the end of the tunnel. There is actually hope. Very much there. And it was two psychologists that developed the idea of post-traumatic growth back in the mid-1990s or 1996 around Richard Tedeschi and Lawrence Calhoun. And their work, really, though, I've heard them being interviewed and at conferences and that, and they say, post-traumatic growth has been around as long as trauma has been around, because there's people have always recovered and come back from that. And it's about the change. I guess more women than men, I need to say, really are experience post-traumatic growth, which is interesting that there is a gender, because when you look at post-traumatic stress disorder, it's again more women than men are affected by it. But in post-traumatic growth, it's certainly more women that seems to, to date, that's not saying that won't change. Of course, there are men too that experience post-traumatic growth. But what happens is there is a change in perspective. This is one of the people who can flourish, and they change their perspective. After a traumatic event, the individual will feel a shift in their worldview, and they reevaluate. They start to think, What was that about? And how am I, you know, there is a sense of what's meaningful and important in my life. And they would have probably missed all of that because they were so busy with their life. But this traumatic event stopped them in their tracks. So they start to question the meaningful things and the important things in their life. And there's an appreciation of the present moment and also a focus on personal growth and well-being that they wouldn't have had before, which is quite an interesting thing. Their relationships are enhanced as well. So they start to value and deepen their interpersonal connections. And they have a lot of compassion as well. Not just compassion for others, but also compassion for themselves. Because we often have a very strong self-critic inside us all that can really derail us. And one of the things about that, they start to say to themselves, they have what's called fierce compassion. I'm okay. This is suffering. This is difficult. But it doesn't mean that it's going to totalize me completely. I am more than this suffering. But this suffering is coming and it's hard. And I'm going to accept it for what it is, but I'm not necessarily going to be feeling that this will be my whole life. It will grow and change as I grow and change, and it will lessen as well. So they have a sense of great empathy for themselves, but also for other people that they see in suffering. So we know, we've often heard of Like, I know that nurses will say, I never understand what it was like for the families of an elderly patient whose mum or dad had a stroke. But when my dad had a stroke and the first patient came into ED, and I thought, oh my goodness, I realized how hard it was for that family. But it doesn't mean to say that, you know, you haven't got empathy. It just becomes something much more deeper and much more profound. There's also an increased resilience. People think, yes, I've got through this. I can get through this. And I know that life will throw me curved balls, but it doesn't mean that I won't bounce back. And can I say a word of caution about resilience? Resilience is very personal. It's very genetic. Some people who are very extrovert and that can really bounce back very quickly and be back. But others can take time, and it's very have compassion for the self and say, it's going to take me time. I am going to feel a bit vulnerable, and my resilience will come back, but it won't come back. I won't compare myself to X or Y. That's their journey. This is my journey. So there's something about respecting that. So your personal strength is tied in with resilience. So people can get I suppose they can come to understand, I have more courage than I thought I had. I didn't realize that I had this courage. And we saw a lot of that in COVID, people saying, oh my goodness, yeah, I never thought I could get through that. And here I am. And it has, you know, so they've a newfound sense of self and an appreciation of them, of themselves. There's also a thing called spiritual growth. This is not religious as such, but some people experience spiritual or existential growth. Some people, of course, may find solace in whatever faith they had, or they may develop a deeper meaning and purpose in life and a real appreciation. So their spiritual appreciation may rest on nature. It may be something to do with belief in a higher power, or it may be a sense that they are really appreciative of life and everything in life as well. A lot of people who have post-traumatic growth, also their coping strategies, they often will adopt healthier coping strategies, and they will prioritize maybe self-care, for example, say, this is important, I need to do this for me. So they're better tuned into themselves and what works best for them. And they often engage in, you know, more stress-reducing activities. That might be going to yoga, might be doing mindfulness, might be attending pottery. And they may seek therapy as well. So they may become more open to talking and trying to understand themselves. They reevaluate their goals. Some people may leave a job, or they may leave partners or relationships, or they may not do anything big like that, but they may just have smaller goals like going to bed earlier or taking time out to sit out and drink a cup of coffee on their veranda or in their garden and just be with nature. So there's a lot of creativity involved in this. It is a process, a very internalized process, but some of the behaviors in that are externalized. So they may, as I said, tap into some creativity that they didn't know they had, whether it could be knitting or film editing or something, photography. Many nurses have reported to me when I talk about to them, as in my role as a wellbeing consultant, about as a result of COVID, they developed new skills. And we all know that we went through a period where we're making sourdough bread. You know, people thought, oh, I could never do that. You can only buy that in the bakery. But then they discovered it. So there was some creativity that came to the fore during that time. So, but again, I want to say that not everyone will experience post-traumatic growth, because I don't want people to, oh, yes, I'm going to experience this. It's an individual process. It's unique to each individual, and the nature of the trauma, the person's coping mechanisms, their social support, their personal characteristics, they all play a role in determining whether post-traumatic growth occurs. These are the contingencies. And so it doesn't negate, though, that you will still have ongoing challenges, even if you have post-traumatic growth. And the symptoms of post-traumatic stress could possibly be there. But it does at some level represent a positive transformation with the distressing. You know, it can help very much. So I do want to say about post-traumatic growth, it's non-linear. It's not like I'll do this and I'll get this. It takes time, and professional support such as counseling or therapy can be helpful for individuals to process and explore their, you know, themselves. It's a time for that to happen, I think.
Thanks. It's very profound, and it's very timely, seeing that we all have been working or trying to work through COVID and come out the other side. Do you have any further words of wisdom for our audience around post-traumatic stress disorder, Finn?
Yes, I'm as much in this as I'm speaking to you about, because this is what it is to be human. The work that I do as a well-being consultant, but also that I've done as a nurse and clinical supervision has informed a lot of where I am. I would say that it's, first of all, there is no shame in seeking help and support. That's really important. Even if you're not, you know, you think, oh, I'm going to be okay, it's nothing, it's still important to reach out to the nursing and midwifery support program or your well-being in your particular area, and know that you're not alone, because there's something that can be very shameful and very kind of concealed, and oh, I'm weak, and your inner critic can really take off and say you shouldn't be looking for help. It can be really quite punitive and punishing. So reaching out to somebody, whether it's a peer supporter, the nursing and midwifery support, or it's EAP, or it's just a colleague that you go and have a cup of coffee with. But it is people that will be understanding and not judging you. So you don't just reach out to anybody. So that's why we often say somebody professional, because, yeah. Also, the thing I would say to people is be patient with yourself, because we know I've had a small cut on my finger. It's only small, but every time I bumped this finger, it was like, oh. And really with trauma, it does take time. And any stress, really stressful event they have, just be patient and practice a lot of self-compassion and say to yourself, this is difficult and I do feel vulnerable. What do I need to do to look after myself? And when the self-critic comes up, you're a wimp, you're this, that's not helpful. It's, you know, doing positive self-talk of saying I'm vulnerable and I need help and I need to wrap my arms around myself. The other thing that I'd say is it's not your fault. So really that blame, the blamer part of ourselves, trauma or stress is not your fault. It's essential to understand that the traumatic event is not solely down to you. So you don't have to carry that. That's too much. And it's really important, that's where your compassion will lie, and say, yeah, I'm going to talk to this. This is bothering me, and I need to talk to somebody professional about that, because I keep blaming myself, and it's not your fault. So small steps as well. You know, this is any event that takes away, you know, takes you out of your normal level of functioning, can take time to come back to your secure base. And the secure base is you feeling happy and confident, and that can take time. So just small steps, even small, like celebrate small sense of progress. Like, oh, I feel like going, having a shower and getting out and meeting friends today. Yeah, that they are small success stories. Self-care. Nurses and midwives typically have been a very well-developed sense of caring for others, and they do that beautifully. It's overdeveloped in actual fact, And the care for the self gets tiny, tiny and reduced. So that's when it's important to put in place something that you're going to do. Intention setting, I find, is very good. Setting your intention in the morning and saying to yourself, yeah, today I intend to accomplish whatever it is. Could be writing a little note in my diary, could be sitting outside and having a cup of coffee or tea in the sunshine, or going for a walk in nature. Now, nature, there is research around to show the healing power of nature is huge. You get much more reduction of stress and reduction of arousal levels when you're walking in a park than you do when you're walking on an urban street, even with trees. So there's something about getting into nature and spending a bit of time there that will help. It's a de-arousal mechanism, but it's also a self-care practice. The other thing I want to speak about that's really, I think, important is to tune into your thinking, your relationship with your thoughts. When you're having a thought, you are not your thoughts completely. And you don't have to believe every thought that you ever had. But you say, I'm having a thought about fear or avoiding something or, yeah, being scared. And then you can say, this is a thought. This is just a thought. But I will acknowledge, I'm not going to try and push it away. I'm going to say, I'm having the thought. But it's just a thought. It doesn't mean in the present moment there's anything in my environment that's threatening me. I'm doing the wash up, everything. This is my alarm system is just trying to protect me. The body continues to try to protect us long after the event has occurred. That's just the body doing what the body has done. And checking in with your values. What do I value? What's the things that I really value? I value honesty. I value friendship. So it's really important to stay connected with people. Yeah, people who are nurturing kind of people, not just any old people. You know, they're supportive of you. They have your interests at heart as well. That's the kind of support networks that you need. Especially when you are feeling vulnerable from a stressful or traumatic event. It's quite important. I also talk to staff about engaging in grounding techniques. And grounding techniques is, we all feel overwhelmed at times, you know, the stress of work coming at us, different people wanting. We feel fragmented and pushed and pulled in different directions. So grounding techniques helps you sustain the present moment. And they can be as simple as just checking into your breath. How's my breath at the moment? And there's one resetting breath that's used, and it's breathing in for three, holding, and then breathing out for four. And that helps to reset the old reptilian brain that's highly aroused and trying to help you when you don't need that kind of help. So that just simple breathing technique can be useful. Another distraction technique, if you're starting to feel aroused and a bit panicky, is the counting backwards from 200, especially at night, because often nighttime is when our fears can rise up. So, counting backwards from 200 can really kind of help. The other thing is being mindful. And when I speak about mindful, if you're doing the wash-up, try and be fully in the moment, feeling the water and the soap on your hands and the plate in your hand or the fork or the knife. And the same with eating or drinking. So starting to really be mindful, just building it in and small little steps. You don't have to do it all the time, but when you remember, say, oh, I could be mindful now when I'm washing my hair, or I could be mindful, I'm going for a walk, just focusing on my footsteps. Yeah, so really being in tune with your body as well. I would ask people to avoid self-medication, because I think that turning to any substances or drugs can be, you know, can be a signal that there's some other help needed. But if you do find that you're wanting to do that, it's important to speak to your GP, and then they will certainly, GPs can refer you on to your psychologist or psychiatrist, depending. So these are important to note. Set your boundaries as well is another one I talk about. Set boundaries with yourself. I'm not going to do this, is outside my remit, or I don't want to, this doesn't make me feel comfortable. So know what, when discomfort arises in your body, it's giving you a signal that something is out of your values. So you set boundaries. And with that, with that's for yourself and also with others, you know, making sure that your needs are met. So as I say, in trauma-informed care, like that, making sure the workplace, especially managers and team leaders, show empathy and positive regard and really respect for the person, and try to, you know, get them, I suppose, hooked in with the nursing and midwifery support program or the wellbeing or EAP. And also, it's useful for people to have some time with talking to friends as well, and being around friends. And I think friends that replenish and nurture you, and the things that bring you joy that you do in your life. Those are just some of my thinking around all of this.
No, I'd call it wisdom. And I thank you so much, Finn, for your time today and your fantastic answers to my questions. That's all for today's podcast. Please remember that support is available whenever you need it. Nurse Midwife Supports on 1-800-667-877. The service is anonymous, confidential and free, and you can call 24/7. You can also contact us via the website nmsupport.org.au. Your health matters. Thank you.